Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC empowers you to experience Jewish paths toward a life of joy, purpose, and meaning through innovative Jewish learning and wellness programs, community building, and initiatives to develop the next generation of Jewish leaders. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 296, Radicalism, Power, Violence, and Meir Kahana. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And we are always excited when one of our earliest guests on Judaism Unbound comes back to the show after a number of years. It's a chance to catch up on some of what we talked about early on, and also a chance to check in on what some of these amazing thinkers and doers are doing now, as opposed to 3 or 4 or 5 years ago in the case of Shaul Magid. He was actually our guest on episode 13 of Judaism Unbound, so one of our very first episodes where we talked about one of his previous books, which was called American Post-Judaism. Today, we are going to be talking with Shaul Magid about a book that he has just published on the thought of Meir Kahana. Now, many of us who know about Meir Kahana or who have thought about him in the last decades have generally thought about him in terms of his political activity in Israel, which was frankly very pernicious and racist, and it was deemed that way by the Israeli Knesset. And it's not something that we would be all that interested in talking about here on Judaism Unbound. But Shaul Magid's recent book on Meir Kahana looks at his thought and his work primarily from the time before he went to Israel, when he was here in the United States. In the book's own words, Meir Kahana, the founder of an organization called the Jewish Defense League, preached radical and violent means to what he termed Jewish survival. The book is entitled Meir Kahana, The Public Life and Political Thought of an American Jewish Radical. It's a look at post-war Jewish radicalism through the lens of this particular figure. Now, as we'll discuss, learning about Meir Kahana is interesting and important for a variety of historical reasons, but it's also important, as Shaul Magid talks about, because some of his critiques do bear responses, and some of his way of thinking and his approaches that we don't like are still active in the world today, and we should have a sophisticated understanding of their origins and how they are able to emerge from certain Jewish ideas that may not on their face be prone to approaches like violence. The book is a tremendous read. It's interesting, disturbing on many levels, and provocative. And rather than saying any more in the introduction, let's probe into it in our conversation with Shaul Magid. So just a few words of reintroduction, because his job has changed since we had him on the podcast 5 years ago. Shaul Magid is now professor of Jewish studies at Dartmouth College and COGOD senior research fellow at the Shalom Hartman Institute of North America. In addition to American Post-Judaism, he is the author of books including Hasidism Incarnate, Hasidism, Christianity, and the Construction of Modern Judaism, and From Metaphysics to Midrash, Myth, History, and the Interpretation of Scripture in Lurianic Kabbalah. Shaul Magid, welcome back to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you again.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So can we get started just with a little bit of an introduction to who Meir Kahana was? And not the whole story, but who was he in a way that's really most significant for America during the time that you write about in the 70s? And who should we know he is today?
Well, he, you know, was an American-born Orthodox Jew from Flatbush, Midwood section of Flatbush. Grew up in what would be called today a kind of modern Orthodox environment in the late 1930s and through the 40s and 50s. But he doesn't really become a public figure until the mid-1960s. Before that, he had various jobs working as a rabbi in a number of different synagogues, working as a sports writer. And in a certain sense, he was kind of headed for what might say a kind of middling career as a modern Orthodox rabbi in America. And then at some point in the 1960s, he begins to enter into what at that point was the emerging counterculture, culture wars, race wars that are happening in the 1960s around the starting, of course, with the assassination of Kennedy earlier, but then the assassination of Malcolm X, the beginning of the Black Panthers, and in a certain way comes into real public notice in 1968 when there was a massive New York City school strike called the Ocean Hill-Brownsville school strike, which really kind of brought the entire New York public school system to a screeching halt. And there were a number of different kind of anti-Semitic pamphlets that were being passed around by African-American and Puerto Rican members of the PTA in those school districts against the school strike. And there's a reason why the anti-Semitism emerges, which we can talk about. And Kahana then founds what he calls the Jewish Defense League, or the JDL, as a response to the anti-Semitism in the African-American community, and begins to kind of organize what can be called civil patrols in some of these neighborhoods that were called then frontier neighborhoods. And at that point, he becomes really almost very quickly a national figure as somebody who was trying to kind of inculcate in American Jewry, and particularly young American Jewry, a sense of renewed Jewish pride, not by a return to religion per se, but by a return to a certain kind of strong, thick Jewish identity.
So thanks for that overview to start. I mean, before we get too far in, I want to be clear to folks listening. This book is not some ode to Meir Kahana. This is not some like celebration of him. Not that anybody would necessarily assume that, but I just want to say that out loud because this is a figure who advocated violence, a figure who not only advocated violence sort of generally, but like directed at specific marginalized groups in many cases. And so I want to sort of say that aloud before we go too far. That said, I want to go there quickly because I want to go there before we're too far into the episode, because a lot of what your book is doing, at least how I read it, is you're taking the small bits that people who have heard of this guy know about him, you know, the small bits that people might know about Meir Kahana or their sort of assumptions, and you're giving a lot of color to them. And in particular, you're taking his really, the sides of him that were tied to literal terrorist attacks later, like Baruch Goldstein, some of his followers. You take that and you help understand how that sort of happened and why this figure, who was in many ways extreme, why he sort of caught hold. And it's not that you're endorsing that, but I think it was a really helpful thing to do, as all of us inhabit a world where other kinds of people who we don't want to gain a public platform do, and then that platform is used in really catastrophic ways. So I guess I'd love to hear from you, like, what are people maybe hearing about Meir Kahana? What do people think that they know about Meir Kahana in various Jewish American circles today? And what aren't they? Like, help us get to that next level that you uncover in your book about who this person is and what their ideas were.
I think that the mistake that many people make in assessing who Meir Kahana was that they begin in the wrong place. As most people, if you talk to them and you ask them about Meir Kahana, most of them will know him as a kind of radical Israeli politician who moves to Israel, founds a political party, is ousted from the Knesset because of he and the party are considered racist. And then in a certain sense begins a kind of clandestine movement that continues to this day, which is focused on violence against the Arab population or removing the Arabs from Israel and those kinds of things. I think that that's the wrong place to start. I think actually that Kahana's Israeli career, he moves to Israel in 1971. So in a certain sense, it's a very interesting snippet. He founds the Jewish Defense League in 1968. He moves to Israel in 1971. Now, in the 70s and 80s, he's still spending about half his time in America and half his time in Israel and continues to write books in English for an American audience. But in a certain way, the entire story of the JDL, of the Jewish Defense League, is from about 1968 to 1974. So it's quite short. But the argument of the book is that, as opposed to what many people think, that Kahana's influence and impact is really much more strongly felt in Israel, and America is just kind of like the prehistory of Kahana. I think it's just the opposite. I think that actually the importance of Kahana as a figure is as an American post-war Jew, and his Israeli career is largely a failure. The movement that we would call the Kahanists today, and they're, you know, Israeli politicians and so on and so forth, the Hilltop Youth in Israel, these groups of people who are perpetrating violence against Palestinians, they're not really Kahanists. They're more what I would call neo-Kahanists, and I can explain the difference between them. They are a kind of homegrown Israeli amalgam of Meir Kahana's militancy and the religious Zionism of rabbis Abraham Isaac Cook and his son Svi Yehuda Cook. One of the interesting things that I want to get across in the book is that for many American Jews, Kahana is somebody that is not really relevant anymore, when I think, in fact, he has dug roots deep into the American Jewish subconscious in ways that continue to reverberate in the American Jewish conversation today. Now, you brought up a good point about militancy and violence and the way in which he saw violence not only as a defensive measure and as a deterrent, but also as a tool of self-fashioning. I think we have to remember that Kahana comes into public notice when violence and radicalism were very much at play in a lot of movements. The Black Panthers, the Young Lords, the Weather Underground, violent militancy was very much a part of what was happening in the late 1960s and early 70s. And in that way, Kahana is just very much a product of his time. But if you separate the militancy and the violence from the worldview, which I try to articulate in the book, his worldview continues to reverberate in American Jewry in ways that we don't really quite understand.
What was really his understanding, his worldview? And I guess one of my questions is, I think by implication, you're saying that he had a kind of a, as you see it, a failed career in Israel. I'm not sure that I fully agree with that, but I guess I'm asking, what is his take on the American Judaism back in the 70s? And how do you see that as having been something that has had a long-lasting impact?
Kahana was a political radical. That's how he defined himself. And in a sense, the point of radicalism is not necessarily to succeed in its goals of overthrowing a country or, you know, some other goal that it might have, but it basically points to and undermines the hypocrisy that it sees in liberalism as a way of changing the nature of culture and society. As a political radical, and he identifies as a political radical. I mean, the interesting thing about Kahana's radicalism is that most of the radicalism at that time was going on the left. But Kahana is actually using that radicalism of the left for the purposes of what we might call the political right. And part of the political right for Kahana was to subvert what he called the American liberal Jewish establishment, which he felt was undermining the possibility for true Jewish continuity in America, either because anti-Semitism was going to threaten American Jewish bodies, or that liberalism was going to embrace Jews to the extent that they were going to lose their identity. Now, this, of course, is not new in Kahana, right? This is something that's very much at play in all Jewish attempts to maintain a sense of sameness and difference simultaneously. But Kahana's real target was liberalism, and particularly Jewish liberalism, what he saw as being an accommodationist, assimilationist attempt to meld in, or what he called melt in, to American society, and thereby basically lose any viable meaning of remaining Jewish in any discernible way. To give you one example, in 1974, he writes this book, Why Be Jewish, about intermarriage. Now, nobody was really writing about intermarriage in 1974, right? The intermarriage rates were actually quite low. But basically, Kahana writes this book about intermarriage, which is a kind of critique of a 1972 sitcom called Bridget Loves Bernie, which was the first television show about intermarriage, about a Jew from the Lower East Side who marries an Upper East Side wealthy Catholic woman. And the whole point of the television show was basically to show that intermarriage is normal. The American Jewish establishment was incredibly disturbed by this sitcom. And even though it was like number four or number three in the Nielsen ratings, they were able to leverage their influence to force Hollywood to cancel it after one season. Basically, Kahane's book is to say to the American Jews, like, I don't understand why you're so upset about Bridget Loves Bernie. You created Bernie, right? Right? American Jewry is Bernieism. So you want to be liberal, you want to be embracing, you want to be tolerant, but you only want Jews to marry Jews. It just doesn't make any sense.
So first off, I'm going to shout out to a past episode we had with Samira Mehta, who wrote a book, Beyond Chrismica, that also looks at Bridget Loves Bernie. I think that moment is really important across a lot of different Jewish conversations, from like Jewish representation in Hollywood to intermarriage as a general conversation. That's very big. So like, bracketing that for a second, if it comes back later, super. But I just want to note that that's really important. I want to name that your book, in a good set of ways, made me very uncomfortable at multiple moments. And the reason for that, I'll speak like autobiographically for a second. Like, I do identify with the Jewish left. It's who I spend a lot of time with. It's where I ideologically situate myself. And a lot of who I am, a lot of what I do in the world is anchored on being part of like this rough, amorphous thing called the Jewish left, a set of organizations, a set of, you know, groups that are Jewish and trying to be progressive or leftist or in various ways commit to social justice. And you had a juxtaposition that floored me. You put Mayor Kahane alongside Arthur Waskow. I believe that Arthur Waskow is one of the most important Jewish teachers and actors, not in the like actor on screen sense, but like doers of my lifetime and also of like a lifetime and a half before my lifetime. He's been on our show. He is one of the key contributors to Jewish social justice as we know it. And you place him alongside this person, Meir Kahane, who represents in so many ways what we would see as the opposite. But what you show is that each of them, in terms of tactics, in terms of how they went about their work, not their goals, but how they went about their work, actually are coming from some shared premises about sort of what effective strategy is. And as somebody who like does strategizing or thinking through the Jewish left, that really made me think and be like, oh my gosh, like I have this happy-go-lucky story of how my set of people are heirs of Arthur Waskow and the Freedom Seder and all of these beautiful sort of developments of the 60s counterculture and decades afterwards. But we're also maybe tied to Meir Kahane in certain senses. So like, help us unpack that. Like, what's at stake or what's happening with these parallels we see between folks that are seemingly ideological opposites?
In Waskow's 1971 book, The Bush is Burning, which is in a certain sense is his great statement of Jewish leftist radicalism, he has a chapter called From Jewish Radicals to Radical Jews. And what he's doing in that chapter is he's talking about the transformation of Jews who were coming out of the New Left in the 1960s, especially after the famous Stokely Carmichael speech in 1966, where Carmichael basically kind of invited all the white people to leave SNCC and in a sense instituted the Black Nationalist Movement. And in 1967, at the New Politics Conference in Chicago, where the New Left adopted a policy against Zionist colonial exploitation. This was literally 3 months after the Six-Day War. So a lot of these New Left Jews, and Waskow was one of them, became alienated from the New Left and moved back into a sense of trying to cultivate and create a Jewish identity, not by abandoning their political radicalism, but by taking that political radicalism and using it for Jewish causes. And in a certain sense, that's the transition for Waskow from Jewish radical to radical Jew. For Waskow, it was about fighting as a Jew in the streets for universal causes of injustice, which is why the Freedom Seder happens a year after King's assassination. For Kahana, it's about fighting as a Jew proudly in the streets, but only for Jewish causes. So in a certain sense, both of them are trying to take Judaism out of the moribund synagogue, out of suburbia, out of a sense of quietism in a certain way, and saying, no, Jews have to be proud as Jews and they have to fight as Jews in the streets. For Waskow, it's for causes of injustice. For Kahana, it's causes of injustice to Jews. So there was in one of the epigraphs of one of the chapters, I quote a JDL member says, if you want to get busted for a Jewish cause. Acts of civil disobedience, Waskow was committed to nonviolence, but acts of civil disobedience, for example, breaking into the Jewish Federation in Los Angeles and putting up mezuzot. Now, those kinds of things, Kahana and Waskow actually shared. Now, I've talked to Arthur about that comparison, and he's not very happy about it. Because for Arthur, he says, I don't agree that you call about calling Kahana a radical. Radicals are on their left. But of course, radicals are not only on the left. We know that's not the case. Because Arthur was protesting against Jewish liberalism, and Kahana was protesting against Jewish liberalism from the opposite sides.
What was Kahana's take on that question of what you were talking about earlier, intermarriage or other things that, you know, one might call assimilatory? What was his approach to that? Because it feels to me like the idea of the Jewish Defense League of sort of defending Jews from anti-Semitism, like was his claim that that was going to be what was going to revive a sense of strong connection to Judaism that might lead someone to not want to intermarry? Or what was his solution to that? Or did he have one?
Interestingly, the solution was not about religion per se. As Kahana says in an interview, right, the JDL, the Jewish Defense League, is not about making people Orthodox. It's about making people proud to be Jews, making them proud to be Jews by acting out as Jews, by wearing, you know, Jewish symbols. So, for example, a lot of people in the JDL wore kippot that weren't Shomer Shabbat, because the kippah wasn't about a religious commitment. It was about a symbol of I am Jewish. And part of that for Kahana, and here he's very influenced by people like Eldridge Cleaver and Malcolm X, part of that is just about cultivating pride, to basically perform Jewishness in an identitarian way, not necessarily a religious way or a ritualistic way, but in a way that cultivates a sense of identity. And I think that he felt that identity is somehow strengthened by the realization and possibility that if Jews are attacked, they're going to fight back. And again, this goes right, it means taking it right out of Malcolm X's playbook. Right, he calls the Jewish Defense League Jewish Panthers. At the same time that he loathed black nationalism because he felt it was anti-Semitic, he was knowingly adopting their position of non-integrationist. So that's really, you know, Malcolm X was a non-integrationist. That was one of his things with King. Right? No, it's not about integration of black children or white children holding hands together, from the famous I Have a Dream speech. No, blacks have to be somewhat separatists, and they have to develop their own school system. They have to develop their own charities. They have to develop their own sense of self and their sense of blackness. And that's what Kahana was trying to do with American Jewry.
Well, so what you're talking about here makes me think about some comments that you have in the book where you kind of talk about, as many have talked about, Kahana as not an especially good thinker or philosopher, right? And that somehow, and I think you say in the book that some people ask you, you know, how are you going to write an academic book on the thought of a middle-brow thinker? What I was thinking about as I was reading this was Donald Trump and the idea that there is a certain kind of person who we're now all very well acquainted with, who has some kind of preternatural understanding and a deep understanding of human beings and human nature and what's going to get people to act in a way that he thinks they should be acting, even though he can't quite articulate that as an impressive sounding philosophy. And I'm wondering if that's what you're finding in Kahana, or if perhaps just the way that I'm hearing you talk about Kahana, he sounds actually more of a thinker than Donald Trump in that way. In other words, I'm hearing more of a sense of a philosophy that might well have reverberations 50 years later today. And so that it's really right to say, actually, what we're seeing today is reverberations of Kahana. Whereas I think a lot of folks look at Donald Trump and they say, you know, he's not really the originator of the ideas or of the approaches that he is embodying today, that actually it's stuff that's much bigger than him. And if he wasn't around, it would sort of happen anyway. Whereas I'm wondering whether you think Kahana really did capture and sort of turn the lights on something very significant.
The difference between Trump and Kahana, they both have obviously that kind of performative quality. I think the main difference between them is that Kahana, I think, and I try to show in the book, actually has a coherent worldview. I don't think Trump really has a coherent worldview. I don't think he really actually believes in anything outside of, you know, protecting himself or making more money or something like that. So in a way, Trump is really the kind of Wizard of Oz of the 21st century. There's really nothing behind the curtain. Whereas I think that Kahana develops a worldview that is an interesting combination of the Cold War and the counterculture. The fear of communism that happens in the 1950s, he was growing up in the McCarthy era. The fear of communism that also becomes the kind of catalyst against the left in America, and the proactive countercultural performative civil disobedience that happens in the 1960s. So I think really getting at Kahana, you have to understand this kind of interesting combination of Cold War anti-communism and 1960s attacks on liberalism. Now, it's interesting in terms of the audience, right? Because Trump has his own audience of alienated white people who are feeling the anxiety of their soon-to-become minority status. For Kahana, it was children of immigrants and Holocaust survivors who were sick of their parents' quiescence and the parents' inability to be able to stand up to the challenges of what was happening in America in the 1960s, who had become radicalized through the new left. That was his audience, really. He was trying to basically take that new left radicalism and translate it into a radicalism for Jewish identity. Now, the interesting thing for me is that most of the Kahanists that I know, or most of the Kahanists that I have in contact with, they don't really actually read his work. The only book that was a success was Never Again, which sold over 100,000 copies the first year it was published in 1971. But other than that, no one really kind of takes him seriously in terms of what he is articulating as a worldview. They identify emotionally and effectively with the program, or they are totally repulsed by it.
I'm really glad you mentioned that title, Never Again. I don't know. And this is not the thrust of the question. I don't know if he invented the phrasing of never again or if he was sort of taking it to the next level. But like, clearly, I inherited a Jewish ecosystem in the United States where the phrase never again was ubiquitous. And it only became more ubiquitous, by the way. Like, I say that as somebody proudly who has done organizing through Never Again Action, you know, a very much not a project that Meir Kahana would support. Never Again Action being a pro-immigration justice platform that emerged during the Trump era and is still operating. But like, never again is a phrase that, whether it originated with him or not, at the very least, the fact that I inherited it is not totally independent from this man's existence. And I bring that up because I really do want to kind of get specific, because you've hinted both in your book and in this conversation that like, we can feel Meir Kahana to this day in Jewish life in different ways. And I really want to like talk about, I know that you as a scholar, like you're not going to say like, if Meir Kahana had never existed, this set of ideas wouldn't be in American Jewish context. I'm not asking for like that strong a claim, but I am curious, like, what does that actually look like? Like, where in somebody's day-to-day existence, whether it's as a synagogue goer, whether it's as a reader of the Jewish press, whether it's, you know, whatever they're doing Jewishly, like, where are we experiencing the influence of Meir Kahana where we might not realize we're experiencing that? I mean, I'm going to start, because I'm a Facebook friend of yours and I see some of your posts, like you've talked about recent articles about like un-Jews, and you've talked about this set of folks on, I don't know if we'd term it the Jewish right or the right center, who really have a problem with claims that tikkun olam, social justice, is the core of Judaism. And they make the claim that it's actually like anti what Judaism stands for. Like that to me is one example of how like, they might not be quoting Meir Kahana, but there's ways in which his thought is influencing what they're bringing on that front. So like, are there other ways in which just sort of day to day in Jewish institutions that we might not be noticing Meir Kahana's influence is part of the equation right now?
His Never Again is in a certain way, again, very specific to the Jewish causes, where the left has taken Never Again as Never Again to anyone. This goes back to the Waskow-Kahana dichotomy, right? Whether you take the Jewish stance and universalize it, or whether you take the Jewish stance and you hyper-particularize it. That basic dichotomy, which is not new in Kahana or in Waskow, but goes all the way back to the 19th century, if we want to like go to the 21st century, I would say the equation of anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. The basic notion that, oh, people say they're not anti-Semites, they're only anti-Zionists, but really it's about anti-Semitism. That is the notion. See, for Kahana, anti-Semitism was part of the DNA of the Gentile. Right? It was not something that was circumstantial, it was not something that was historical, it was not something that was even solvable. Anti-Semitism is part of what it meant to be a Jew in the world. The only thing the Jew can do is manage it. And that's in a certain sense for him what violence was, right? You don't eradicate anti-Semitism. All you do is make sure that the anti-Semite has to think twice before they hit you, because you know they know that you're going to get it back twice as hard. And I think that the anxiety that we feel today defining anti-Semitism with the IHRA document, the IHRA document, or with the Jerusalem document, questions of the progressive left talking about BDS or talking about anti-Zionism and the way in which Jews have been writing about, whether it's Barry Weiss or Deborah Lipschitz, it's all in a certain sense not Kahanaism per se, it's Kahanaist, not Kahanaism. In other words, it's in a certain sense, he was saying then that is the reality. The person that I feel in a certain sense, in a very intellectualized sense, that in a certain way is more Kahanaist than other people that we see is like Ruth Weiss in her book, Jews in Power. In other words, that's what it is. It's about power. For Kahana, survival is about power. So today we talk about Jewish continuity, right? That's a big industry. Kahana talked about it in the 1970s as Jewish survival. But in a certain sense, survival and continuity are really kind of the same thing. It's just continuity is a more genteel, less militaristic and militant way of saying it. How do you create the rubrics for Jews to remain Jews? And it's all living under the cloud of perennial anti-Semitism. And I think that has deeply affected the Jewish conversation today. And that was something that Kahana was talking about in 1970.
Are we giving Kahana too much credit by calling this stuff Kahanist or Kahan-like or whatever? Because this is kind of ideas that have been in Judaism for a long time. And is it better to say that Kahana was a particularly pernicious example of what can happen when this kind of nationalist idea of radicalism goes to its extreme? And would it be somehow more helpful to not identify these things with a particular exemplar? I think about people who are on the left will say Castro, you know, and it's like, okay, we could talk about Castro, but I mean, by talking about Castro, we sort of, it's sort of a way of not talking about the serious ideas that he may have been an especially terrible exemplar of.
I'll agree with you here. I don't think Kahana was really an innovator. Kahana basically offered a particular articulation of a series of issues and views that had already existed before him in a particular moment in post-war America, the beginning of a turn of America from being a more liberal society to being a more conservative society with the election of Nixon, for example, the rise of neoconservatism in the 1980s. So in a certain way, Kahana simply was an articulator of a particular set of well-oiled issues that reverberated into the future beyond him. Now, the question, I think, importantly, is raised to say, have we moved beyond that influence? And I think one of the things that undermines the continued relevance of Kahana is the rise of multiculturalism. We have to remember, Kahana was living in a pre-multiculturalist society. The multiculturalism of the celebration of diversity and so on and so forth, in a certain sense, undermines some of the dangers that he thought was going to happen to American Jewry. I think that you're right to say that he didn't bring anything new into the world. He offered a particular articulation that lasted. Multiculturalism kind of put a stop to it. But I think we're living in a post-multicultural world, in a sense, where some of these issues are coming back. If you look at the fact that there are many Israelis and Jewish supporters of Israel on the right that are saying, well, actually, maybe Judaism and democracy can't fit together. Kahana was saying that in the 1970s, right? The only people in the 1970s that were saying Judaism and democracy, a Jewish state, democratic state is impossible, were people on the far left. Everybody else was saying, oh, yeah, it can work. Now, all of a sudden, people are saying, well, you know, if we really have to choose, maybe we'll choose a Jewish state and not a democratic state. So in a certain sense, he lays out a particular set of issues that gestate, and I think in some cases, on the Jewish state and democratic state in Israel, are really coming to fruition. Where not now it's not even people on the radical right. There are people even on the center right that are saying, well, yeah, maybe it won't work. And so if it doesn't work, we'll choose a Jewish state. Kind of what the 2018 nation state law actually said, right? That the state of Israel is only the state of the Jewish people. It's not a state of all its citizens. Now, in a certain sense, that's a classic Kahana statement, right? He would have stated back in the 60s, yeah, the Jewish state is not a state of all its citizens. It's only a state of the Jewish people.
I'm struck by the way in which you brought up multiculturalism. And I'm struck for a few reasons. One, the last time we had you on the show, we talked about your book, American Post-Judaism, which really is, I mean, I don't want to paraphrase too thoughtlessly, but it's a long-form meditation on questions of melting pot, questions of multiculturalism, questions of post-ethnicity that you bring up, and that I sort of hear hints of in what you just said. And one thing I have felt privileged to gain over the years with certain authors who I've read like multiple of their books is sort of a sense of the ongoing journey of their scholarship. And even in this book about Meir Kahana, which is about Meir Kahana, I sense that there's also those deep lurking questions around how we orient societies with different cultures, different ethnicities, how identity works, those kinds of questions. And I guess I'm curious to get a little bit autobiographical from you. Are there ways in which this is actually sort of continuing work that you were doing in previous books of yours? And are there sort of ongoing questions that transcend your individual books that you sort of see yourself as continuing to work through over the years and that maybe you'll continue to work through in the future?
The Meir Kahana book is a sequel to American Post-Judaism. I say that not only euphemistically, but in the last chapter of the book on the Holocaust, I have a small section on Meir Kahana and his response to the Holocaust. And in a certain way, it was through writing that chapter that I began to actually seriously write about him. And one of the things that I didn't really deal with in American Post-Judaism that I deal with in this book is the role of political radicalism. What I wanted this book to be more than a book about Meir Kahana, it's not really a biography about Meir Kahana, you're not going to know that much about his, you know, his life, is I wanted it to be an intervention into post-war American Jewish political radicalism through the lens of a volatile, influential thinker. And now I consider myself a political radical on the left. Radicalism itself is at the center of the book. I'm very interested in radicalism as an ideology, as a position, as a critique of liberalism. He is useful for me because his critique of liberalism is not that different than mine, except we come out on the opposite ends. So, for example, when they asked Abby Hoffman in a radio interview what he thought of Mayor Kahane, he said, well, I agree with his tactics, but not his goals. These people were on each other's radar screen, right? Because political radicals, left and right, often share a certain enemy, so to speak. That is their critique of liberalism. It's fully autobiographical, as much as I am the polar opposite of Kahane as a thinker and as an activist, the extent that I'm an activist. I think that he was able to put his finger on a particular vulnerable spot of hypocrisy in the American liberal project, the American Jewish liberal project, that really is worth those on the political left to pay attention to.
I don't want to keep asking versions of like, where is Kahane in this Jewish institution? But like, I do think that that's really valuable for people to sit with, like that this person has in fact continued to influence our society, whether it was him just himself or just sort of his broader ideological universe. I'm thinking about a few things. First off, you talked about survival and continuity, and it reminded me very much of conversations we've had with Lila Corwin Berman about how the Jewish institutional nonprofit world has constructed its sort of framing questions over the decades. And it's not just that sort of on an individual level, people are nervous about Jewish continuity and all the intermarriage stuff you talk. It's that we've literally constructed an entire ecosystem where questions of Jewish pride, how much Jewish pride certain groups have, are the young Jews participating in this thing? Like all these fear-based questions that ultimately boil down to, are we losing Jews from Judaism or are we not, or are we gaining them? Like that's how we've structured the whole thing. And without asking you like, is that Kahane's doing? Like that's not really the question I have. I do think at the very least, there's a relationship between what I'm hearing you describe as Kahane's worldview and his concerns and some of the concerns of, you know, very good, well-meaning Jewish organizations, JCCs, synagogues, like places that are worried about filling their pews or having members. I'm not saying that they have some deep sadistic agenda where they're advocating for violence or oppression, but I am interested, like, when we look around at a Jewish world that continues to ask questions in surveys about, are Jews doing X, Y, or Z? Does that correlate with what we call Jewish identity or Jewish pride? How might we take the fact that Mayor Kahane and his thinking is sort of part of what seems to be contributing to those kinds of questions?
Yeah, I think Lila's work is incredibly important. I mean, she's coming at it from a different perspective. But I think that she and I both have serious questions about the project of Jewish liberalism and the way in which it's in some way constructing its institutional framework. And that was kind of the work that she did in Jewish philanthropy. And toward what end? If the end is simply making Jews, and this is kind of what Stephen Cohen and Jack Wertheimer are interested in, right? I just care about Jewish bodies. I just want there to be more Jews. I don't really care that much about what they
do. You're quoting them.
Yeah, I'm quoting them, right. Yeah. In other words, it's all, you know, so for, you know, it's about a certain kind of pronatal Judaism or, you know, it's all about zip codes, right? It's you live with Jews and then you become more Jewish, right? In a certain sense, it becomes a numbers game for those individuals, and that's a legitimate point of view. For me, it doesn't really do the work. The notion of Jewish pride, which we don't talk about so much, we talk about Jewish identity. So it's interesting the way these terms become morphed from one thing to another: survival to continuity, pride to identity, as a way of, in a certain sense, normalizing, in a sense, liberalizing what was originally a much more radical position. When Kahane says in the 1980s, he says, yeah, I want a radical Jew. I just want them to have something to be radical about. For Kahane, it wasn't about putting on tefillin and keeping Shabbos. It was about getting busted for a Jewish cause. So, for example, I talk about it in the March 2, 1971 Soviet Jewry demonstration in Washington, D.C., which was one of the, probably his most successful event. He gets up and he says to the people, to the kids that are being arrested, this is your bar mitzvah. In other words, this is the initiation into Jewishness. You're getting arrested for Soviet Jews. Forgetting about the smorgasbord and the Viennese table and the synagogue where you read the Haftarah and you don't really understand what you're reading. That's not your bar mitzvah. This is the initiation. Kahana wanted to take Judaism to the streets long before there was a Jewish social justice movement. I'm not going to mention the name, but one of the leaders of the Jewish social justice movement just actually emailed me today, and she said, you know, I'm reading your book, and I'm a little afraid to say I'm kind of sympathetic to Kahana. Now, another person who I know well, who's an important Jewish sociologist, wrote me today and said, well, I read your book, and I wondered, are you really saying that in some way there's like a little bit of Kahana in each of us? Right? So it was kind of an interesting statement, right? There's something about those of us who are committed to the Jewish project in all the different ways that we're committed to it, whether it's progressive politics, whether it's religion, whatever it is, that in some way, what he was articulating in the 1960s and 1970s, there's some little piece of it. I'm not necessarily going to go throw eggs at the limos. I'm not going to throw rocks at the windows. I'm not going to throw firebombs, right? But there's something about that that rings true in some way.
But it's interesting because I guess I'm happy to identify myself with Abbie Hoffman in this case. Like I like that idea that I like his tactics, but not his objectives or whatever it was that exactly he said. His goals. And that's where, like, yeah, I think that you're, like Lex was talking about earlier, that you're putting Arthur Wasco and Kahana in the same couple of paragraphs is interesting, because that's what helps you see, yeah, when I'm attracted to this figure, when there are things about this figure that I'm attracted to, it's not really him. You're either attracted to the whole package or you're not. And if you're attracted to half the package, then I would say, like, okay, where can I find the whole package somewhere else that I'm attracted to? And you can sort of allow yourself to say, yeah, there's something here. I should examine what it is that attracts me, but that doesn't mean to kind of leave it there, you know? And I think that that's the kind of sophisticated thought that's important when you're dealing with a figure like this. So I want to ask you, though, about that dark side of Kahana that ultimately transmogrified into this racism against Palestinians. And I think, I don't know, well, you could talk more about how broad his racism was. And it strikes me that there's a way to say, look, hey, we've got this problem of Jews not being that into being Jewish anymore. What's the solution? You could say, well, the problem is internal. The problem is that we're not finding it compelling enough. And my objection to that natalist kind of approach is to say the problem isn't that Jews are not having enough babies or that Jews are not marrying other Jews. The problem is that Jews don't know why Judaism is so great. And the solution shouldn't be trying to hold on to greater numbers of Jews. The solution should be trying to work on Judaism to make it more exciting and more great. But so one response, though, is that sort of natalist approach that says, how are we going to not solve this problem without solving it? How are we going to address the symptoms by somehow making it more likely that Jews are going to marry other Jews? Because then even though they still hate Judaism, at least their next generation will be Jewish and maybe there'll still be a chance. And the other approach, which strikes me as it's more Kahana's approach, is to blame somebody else, right? And to focus all of my work on saying that the reason why we have a problem, or maybe the way that we're going to solve a different problem, is by turning our attention to fighting others or to blaming others, that often becomes this, again, you know, to draw the connection to Trump, this politics of grievance, which is very powerful and very effective, but ultimately bad.
I think what he's saying is there is a paradox, and the paradox is that liberalism and liberal America has been better to the Jews than any other society in the history of the Jewish people. I mean, he says that in Time to Go Home, he says that very explicitly, right? America has been better to the Jews than any other country in history. And yet, that is what will destroy the Jews, right? That's the paradox, right? It's precisely that society on two fronts. Either it will make Jews feel so comfortable that there won't be enough Jewishness left for them to hang on to, or that even in its tolerance, or it will not be able to prevent the rise of anti-Semitism. And that's kind of what you're hearing in the present conversations about anti-Semitism, that anxiety, right? The way in which American Jews are now suddenly feeling anxious about, will America really protect us? Will it really be able to protect us? That, Kahane is saying, the answer to that is no. And that was something that Kahane really tried to push very hard in the American Jewish consciousness at a time when they simply didn't believe it.
You're a rabbi. And I think that all of the scholarship you're doing here, I mean, there are sort of spiritual questions or communal questions, like questions that are not just scholarship kinds of questions that arise. How do we, as Jews, confront, whether it's Kahane or in general, like advocacy for violence in our tradition, whether that's advocacy for violence in the Book of Joshua or in something Meir Kahane wrote a few decades ago? Like, what do we do with Jewish tradition when it does, in many ways, call on our deepest, most problematic impulses towards violence, towards oppression of others? What might we do today? Like, what might people who are realizing, oh, we have this Kahane-esque part of us, whether that's individually or communally, how do we confront it?
One of the things that we need to think carefully about is to erase some of the kind of apologetics that's kind of very common within the Jewish conversation, say, oh, Judaism doesn't advocate violence, or Judaism is a nonviolent religion. Now, first of all, that's not true about any religion. That's not true about any nationalist movement. That's not true about any nation state. Human beings are violent, right? As Hannah Arendt said, it's not about violence and nonviolence. It's about when violence is warranted and when violence is not warranted. That's really the question. And I think in a way, we do ourselves a disservice by saying that Judaism is in some way not a nonviolent religion. Now, there are some very significant aspects of the tradition that are or that do advocate nonviolence, even to the form of pacifism among some thinkers. Kahane would say, well, Judaism begins with a violent act, right? Moses kills the Egyptian. I mean, the Egyptian is beating the Israelite. Moses kills the Egyptian and runs away, and then he has the burning bush, and that's like the beginning of the story. So the story itself is a violent story. No? And in some way, you know, there's something to that. As a rabbi, I would say, we need to have a real conversation about violence and when it's merited and when it's not and how to use it and questions of power. I mean, back in the 1960s and 70s, people like David Hartman, Yitzhak Greenberg said, the real challenge of Judaism in the latter part of the 20th century, how will Jews deal with power? Meaning, how will Jews deal with violence? Because now we actually have the ability to commit acts of violence in a serious way. And how are we going to use the resources of our tradition to understand when that's warranted and when that's not warranted? Kahane has a particular view of violence, one that I'm critical of, but also sympathetic to, not because I believe that it's applicable, but at least he's willing to put violence on the table and not kind of move in this direction of Jews are being nonviolent, because for Kahane, nonviolence is really an act of weakness, especially if you're confronted with violence. Now, the pacifist might say, yes, but that's actually the position I'm going to take. So instead of saying, oh, I am going to consider martyrdom because that is the, you know, I'm going to be the model of Rabbi Akiva and allow myself to be killed, as opposed to fighting back, because that's what I see as the theological program of the tradition. But Bar Kokhba says, no, we're actually going to fight back. We're going to have an insurrection against the Romans, and we're going to try to take the temple back. And of course, he lost horribly, and you know, many people were killed, and so on and so forth. So in a certain way, I think that we need to stop saying or thinking or teaching that, oh, Judaism is not violent. Other religions are violent. And when Israel is violent, it's only violent defensively. It's only violent for security. Because almost everybody says that. and start thinking about, seriously, about violence as a very dangerous tool that we use, but one that we necessarily are given as a result of the fact that we're living in at a time now where Jews actually have power. So we can argue about, oh, was the Israeli response to Gaza appropriate? Was it proportionate or disproportionate? And people will, oh, you know, from the pro-Israel side, it's always okay, right? It's always kind of, you know, proportionate. If you say it's disproportionate, you have an anti-Israel bias. But we're blowing up people's neighborhoods, right? We're killing people. We're killing women and children. Now, you can say that it's necessary, but then make the argument that it's necessary. I think he at least raises the issue of violence in a way that could allow us to have the conversation and finally put away this kind of false notion that somehow Judaism is a nonviolent religion.
I wanted to close this episode where you started the book with this vignette about being at a bar mitzvah in an Orthodox community, and you're standing there online with the person, and you mentioned that you're working on this book about Kahana, and he just tells you casually, oh yeah, I really agree with everything he said. That's what he said. Everything he said. I just wish he said it a little nicer. And it feels to me like there's a possibility that some of these ideas and even actions that may have been justified in a particular extreme situation. And yeah, that it's not right to say that Judaism is never for violence. Judaism is sometimes for violence, but the danger of getting into that is that you end up saying it's always for violence. And I wonder whether something has happened over the last 50 years where maybe these two worlds represented by Wasco and Kahana have diverged in such a way that makes it very hard for them to continue to see themselves as one community? Is there really a possibility that somebody who may or may not be representative of a larger community who says that I agree with everything Kahana said, and he's saying that 50 years on, you know, when I don't think he's making a sophisticated claim that he agreed with everything Kahana said when it wasn't, you know, all that controversial. And a community that you've described as a post-Judaism community, can we really see those two sort of continuing to go on together?
It's a good question to end on. I think probably not. I'm not a big fan of Jewish unity. I think it's a myth. I don't think it ever existed. I don't think that it ever will exist. Questions of tolerance and conversation and pluralism, those are different things. But the notion of Jewish unity basically means people should really mostly think what I think. Right? Who's ever actually talking about the unity question? I do think that the divergence is actually pretty severe right now. I think that Trump played a role in that. The Orthodox and traditional communities are now seeing themselves much more aligned with a more radically conservative evangelical base because they share certain concerns and they share a fear of the left. I think especially young Jewish progressives who are engaged in Black Lives Matter and other kinds of movements are distancing themselves from the center. There are increasing numbers of American Jews who are expressing their engagement with Israel through critique. The establishment such as this doesn't really have an answer because they would say, oh yeah, we want you to be engaged with Israel. And they say, if not now, we'll say, yeah, I'm engaged with Israel as a critic of Israel. And they say, no, we don't want you to be engaged that way. And they say, well, you don't get to choose how I'm engaged. You taught me to be engaged, right? So I think that the Zionization of American Jewry is coming back in a sense to bite itself on the other side because these people have been trained to be engaged in Israel. And now that engagement is going in that way. And I also think, I think this is an important point. I think Israel is choosing a different path. Israel is choosing the way it wants to go. And most liberal and progressive American Jews won't go there. And that may be a natural parting of the ways. These are two different communities. There's a nation state on one side. There's a very integrated, powerful, and influential community on the other side of the ocean, and they don't necessarily have to see themselves as being tied together. So I do think that we're moving further apart, both in America, right and left, and in Israel. And it would be more interesting for me to really think about what the implications are rather than to kind of, you know, clutch at our collective pearls and kind of get involved in a kind of, oh my Godism, what is really happening?
Thank you so much, Shaul, for joining us. This has been a fantastic conversation.
Thank you. It's great to talk to you.
And thank you so much to all of you out there for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this conversation, and we hope you'll tune in again in the future. We also hope that you will purchase Shaul Magid's book about Meir Kahana. You can check it out on the Princeton University Press website. You can check it out on any website that is selling books. You should be able to find it in our show notes as well that you can check out on our website. So definitely give it a read. We thank you again for listening in. We hope that you will be in touch with us if you have questions or thoughts or comments, anything. And here are all the different ways that you can be in touch with us. First, there are our Facebook and Instagram and Twitter feeds. All of those are Judaism Unbound. There's our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can hit us up via email at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. The last request we'd like to make is that we deeply appreciate any amount of financial donation that you can send our way. And you can do that via judaismunbound.com/donate on either a monthly recurring basis or just as a one-time gift. So thank you so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound. 345 more days of Shemitah.